I declare before you all that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and to the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong. But I shall not have strength to carry out this resolution alone unless you join in it with me, as I now invite you to do. I know that your support will be unfailingly given. God help me to make good my vow, and God bless all of you who are willing to share in it.
Elizabeth was born on the 21st of April, 1926. Her father was Prince Albert, Duke of York, and her mother, Elizabeth Bowes Lyon. Bertie, as he was known, and later George VI, was the second son of King George V and Queen Mary. Elizabeth was born at her maternal grandfather's home on 17 Bruton Street in Mayfair by caesarean section. She was baptised by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Cosmo Lang. When she was born, she was third in line to the throne, behind her uncle and her father. The assumption was that her uncle would produce an heir, and therefore Elizabeth would be unlikely to succeed the throne. Despite this, her birth was met with great excitement. For most of the day, reporters stood outside 17 Bruton Street, and they would nickname her Princess Betty. Elizabeth had one sibling, a sister named Margaret, born in 1930. She became the first royal in the direct line of succession born in Scotland since the 17th century. Due to the busy schedules of her parents, she spent most of her childhood under the supervision of nannies and her governess, Marion Crawford, at her parents' home at 145 Piccadilly in London. Crawford later released a biography of the princesses, Angering the Royals, where she offered an unauthorised insight into the lives of the young princesses. While it was largely a kind-hearted account of their upbringing, she did claim that the girls lived isolated lives and did not see enough of the real world around them. Crawford was permanently ostracised from the royals. She also claims that she wanted to take them to ride the London Underground, to play in a public park, and to mix with ordinary children, none of which were permitted. Unlike the king, Elizabeth's mother and father valued a warm, fun-filled family life and ensured that they spent at least an hour a day with their daughters. Elizabeth would also spend lots of time with her paternal grandparents, the Earl and Countess of Strathmore at Glamis Castle in Scotland. The young princesses were often visited by their doting Uncle David, the future Edward VIII. Their father would nickname his family We Four. This was a surprisingly close and modern royal family. When her parents went abroad on tours, she would keep in touch using the first royal transatlantic telephone. The first one was made on the 18th of May 1927. She was also very close to her paternal grandparents. An equerry was shocked to see the king on his hands and knees playing the part of a horse while two-year-old Elizabeth rode him around the garden. She would call George V Grandpa England. She was known as Lilibet by her family. This was the name Elizabeth had for herself when she was learning to talk. She cheered the king up when he was suffering from health problems in the late 1920s. The doctor recommended Elizabeth as the perfect tonic. She went down with him to Bognor Regis and played him a sand while the old king sat in the sunshine watching her. Elizabeth appreciated the outdoors from an early age and became an animal lover, particularly horses and dogs. This would last a lifetime. During her childhood, the family owned 8 corgis, which famously became Elizabeth's favourite breed. She was given her first pony at the age of 4 by her father and began taking riding lessons the following year. She would continue to ride until the final months of her life. According to Winston Churchill, Elizabeth had an air of authority and reflectiveness that was astonishing in an infant. She was a jolly little girl, but fundamentally sensible and well-behaved, according to cousin Margaret Rhodes. She would line up all her shoes outside of her nursery and line up all of her toys each night before bed. She stopped when her sister, a talented mimic, would do impressions of her routines. She would also keep careful records of gifts she received in order to send thank you notes and would save wrapping paper for further use. Margaret, on the contrary, was seen by some in the family as having a difficult character, in particular her frankness and mischievousness. The pair established their own Girl Guides troop at Buckingham Palace, allowing them to interact with other children. The other children were, of course, carefully vetted. However, her academic training was limited. The family were largely opposed to Elizabeth attending school, believing it would be too difficult for them to receive a normal education due to her status. Her father had a particularly strong protective impulse and was perhaps influenced by his own difficult experiences, particularly the pressure to succeed despite his limited academic ability. There was also public pressure on women to avoid academia and take on more traditional female roles. Elizabeth's mother was resistant to a full day of tutoring, with just a couple of hours being sufficient for her. Queen Mary, on the other hand, believed that princesses should have a varied education and began taking the girls to museums and galleries. On the 20th of January 1936, King George V died. Elizabeth moved to second in the line of succession. Within a year, her uncle Edward VIII abdicated. This meant her father became George VI. Elizabeth, at just 10 years old, was the heir to the throne. The family moved from 145 Piccadilly to Buckingham Palace. Shocked by the size of Buckingham Palace, to get around, Elizabeth observed, "People need bicycles." Now Elizabeth's parents were king and queen, she spent far less time with them. Now that she was more than likely to ascend the throne, she was tutored by C.H.K. Martin, later the Provost of Eton College, in constitutional law and history. She would learn valuable lessons. Martin would emphasise the importance of adaptability, something for which she would later become famous. As Elizabeth entered her teenage years, Britain entered the Second World War. Upon the outbreak, it was suggested that the princesses be evacuated to Canada. This was rejected by their mother. "The children won't go without me. I won't leave without the king, and the king will never leave." Instead, to escape the Blitz, Elizabeth and her sister spent most of their time in the relative safety of the royal castles. They would listen to radio broadcasts and read the newspapers daily, hoping for good news.
St. Paul's Cathedral was the pivot of the main fire. All around it, the flames were leaping up into the sky. There the cathedral stood, magnificently firm, untouched in the very centre of all this destruction.
The princesses staged pantomimes at Christmas in aid of the Queen's Wool Fund, which bought yam to knit into military garments. The King and Queen insisted that their daughters follow the national rationing requirements. During the Blitz, the princesses were secretly transported to Windsor Castle for their protection, while their parents remained at Buckingham Palace. A plan was created to whisk the princesses away to a safe house, if required. The press did not reveal their location. It was a gloomy and frightening period. Lights were dimmed, blackout curtains were fitted at every window, and gas masks were clean and near at hand. A total of 300 bombs landed in the grounds of Windsor Castle. In October 1940, a 14-year-old Elizabeth made her first radio broadcast during the BBC's Children's Hour, addressing other children who had been evacuated.
"Thousands of you in this country have had to leave your homes and be separated from your fathers and mothers. My sister, Margaret Rose, and I feel so much for you, as we know from experience what it means to be away from those we love most of all."
Keen to play her part in the war effort, upon her 16th birthday in 1942, She signed on for work at a labour exchange. However, she was not offered any work. The reason why remains unclear. However, the king's reluctance may have been a factor. Her father ensured that Elizabeth would only be permitted to serve once victory was assured, and victory was near. She was appointed Colonel-in-Chief of the Grenadier Guards by her father. Elizabeth made her first public appearance, inspecting the troops in 1942. In February 1945, in the closing months of the war in Europe, Elizabeth joined the Auxiliary Territorial Service and trained as a driver and mechanic. It was seen as a morale boost for the British people. On VE Day, Elizabeth, in uniform, joined her parents, her sister, and Prime Minister Winston Churchill on the balcony at Buckingham Palace. Then, in perhaps Elizabeth's most rebellious moment, with Margaret, took to the streets of London to celebrate with the crowds. We asked my parents if we could go out and see for ourselves. I remember we were terrified of being recognised. I remember lines of unknown people linking arms and walking down Whitehall. All of us just swept along on a tide of happiness and relief. In 1934, Elizabeth had met Prince Philip of Greece and Denmark. The pair were just 8 and 13 years old respectively. They were second cousins, once removed, through King Christian IX of Denmark and Queen Victoria. After meeting again in 1939, during a visit to the Royal Navy College in Dartmouth, where Philip was training, the pair henceforth exchanged letters. Philip's uncle, Louis Mountbatten, was encouraged by the thought of his nephew potentially courting the young princess when she was old enough. Philip served in the Royal Navy in the Mediterranean and the Pacific. He would visit Elizabeth when able, and was invited to spend Christmas with the royal family in 1943. 2 years after the war, in July 1947, the pair announced their engagement. Elizabeth was 21. It was her most controversial decision. The pair were very different. Elizabeth was quiet, reserved, and dutiful. Philip was boisterous, outspoken, and rebellious. There were also persistent rumours of possible infidelities. The king accepted the pair, though he was not warmly welcomed into the royal family. However, more importantly, in the wake of the abdication crisis and the war, the establishment was particularly suspicious of outsiders. He was foreign-born, had little financial standing, and had several links to Nazi Germany. Three of his four sisters had been card-carrying Nazis, one of whom, Margarita, was married to Prince Gottfried of Hohenlohe-Langenburg, an officer in the Wehrmacht. Philip's younger sister, Sophie, was married to Christoph of Hesse, a member of the SS, and an officer in the Luftwaffe. Despite his foreign origins, he had served in the Royal Navy. Nevertheless, many had their reservations, including the Queen, who would nickname him the Hun. The media too did not warm to Elizabeth's new fiancé. Philip renounced his Greek and Danish titles, converted to Anglicanism, and adopted his mother's surname, Mountbatten. He was created Duke of Edinburgh, granted an HRH, and was admitted into the Order of the Garter by George VI. The pair were married in a dreary post-war austerity Britain on the 20th of November 1947 at Westminster Abbey. The wedding was politically difficult. A potentially ostentatious wedding was seen as a mistake. It was orchestrated cautiously. None of Philip's sisters were invited to the wedding, nor was the exiled Edward VIII. Elizabeth bought her dress with World War II ration coupons and returned donations from women around the UK. However, the media got behind the wedding, and the pomp and ceremony served as an escape for the British people. 2,500 presents and 10,000 telegrams were sent to the couple. Mahatma Gandhi sent a loincloth. Churchill noted, "The wedding was a flash of colour on the hard road we have to travel." George VI wrote a letter to Elizabeth after the wedding, I'm so proud and thrilled having you so close to me on our long walk to Westminster Abbey. But when I handed your hand to the Archbishop, I felt that I had lost something very precious. I can see that you are sublimely happy with Philip, which is right. But don't forget us. Just a year after their wedding, Elizabeth gave birth to their first child, Charles, in 1948, followed by Anne in August 1950. In their post-wedding years, the pair split their time between Windlesham Moor, Windsor, Clarence House in London, and Malta, where Philip, still serving as a Royal Navy officer, was stationed. After the war, in anticipation of her role as Queen, Elizabeth began taking on more royal duties. She had become one of the five councillors of state, usually the next four eligible people in the line of succession, in 1944. A member of a royal family to whom the monarch can delegate duties, such as attending Privy Council meetings and having access to the red boxes. She now had her own household and office. In 1947, Elizabeth embarked on a royal tour for the first time, accompanying her parents to Southern Africa. There, on her 21st birthday, she made a famous pledge to her future subjects. Elizabeth would not have very long to enjoy this relative freedom and quaint family life. The King's health had been declining since the late 1940s. He was diagnosed with lung cancer in 1951 and had his left lung removed. The diagnosis was kept from the King due to the stigma around the disease. Elizabeth and Philip were forced to take on more public duties, and Philip was forced to give up his naval career. The establishment were readying themselves for the King's death. Accession declarations were carried with the Princess in case the King were to pass when she was on tour. On the 31st of January, the Duke and Duchess of Edinburgh, Elizabeth and Philip, embarked on a tour of Australia and New Zealand via Kenya. The King saw them off from London Airport against advice from his doctors. It would be the last time Elizabeth would see her father. The Duke and Duchess of Edinburgh stayed in the Treetops Hotel. They then stayed at Sagana Lodge. At which point, word reached Philip of the King's death. There was a significant delay in the news reaching the pair. The staff found out first. A servant was ordered to sneak into their room and remove a radio in case it was reported, so the news could be revealed sensitively. It was Philip who led Elizabeth into the garden to break the news. Calmly, she sat to send letters of apology for the abrupt end to the tour and hastily returned to London. And so it was that she was proclaimed Queen Elizabeth II while in Kenya, the first monarch to succeed the throne while abroad since George I in 1714. When Queen Mary, her grandmother, visited Elizabeth soon after her arrival, she insisted on being the first to kiss her hand. Mary did not live to see Elizabeth's coronation. Soon there was disagreement over Elizabeth's name. The establishment favoured Elizabeth retaining the name Windsor, while Philip complained, "I am the only man in the country not allowed to give his name to his own children." A compromise was reached. Mountbatten Windsor was therefore adopted for all their male line descendants who did not carry royal titles. It would prove difficult in the early years for the independent and ambitious Philip to adapt to a support role. It was the first coronation to be broadcast live. There had been opposition in the past, particularly George VI, which had been rejected by Cosmo Lang. Ordinary people could not be trusted to show the proper reverence. They may even listen to the sacraments while drinking in a pub with their hats on. There was more opposition for this coronation, with Churchill arguing that it would ruin the solemnity of the event. However, Philip and the press were strongly in favour. They got their wish, yet the anointing of Queen Elizabeth was not televised. Elizabeth was crowned on the 2nd of June 1953. She was the 39th monarch and 6th queen regnant to be crowned at Westminster Abbey. A new recipe was created by florist Constance Spry for foreign guests who were to be entertained after the coronation. It was called Coronation Chicken and remains popular to this day. The majority of the British population had tuned into televisions and radios, many of which had been rented specially, with millions more around the world. Following the coronation, the Queen and Prince Philip embarked on a 7-month tour. She became the first reigning British monarch to visit Australia and New Zealand, where an estimated 75% of the entire population came out to see her. As she travelled through the New Zealand town of Bluff, with a population of 3,000, 200,000 people were there to greet her. During her reign, she became the most widely travelled head of state in history. When she returned to the UK, she commented on the state of the Thames. "Look at this awful, dirty river." Her first Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, responded, "This is the silver thread, and it flows through British history. Never forget it." In the same year, the Queen knighted her Prime Minister. "I took it because it was her wish, and I think she's splendid." Britain's wartime Prime Minister finally resigned in 1955 at the age of 81 and died in 1965 at the age of 90. His state funeral was the largest in history to that point. Early in her reign, the Queen was under pressure due to economic and political complications. When Harold Macmillan resigned in 1963 due to ill health, he convinced the Queen to appoint Alec Douglas Hume from the House of Lords, in the absence of a process for electing leaders, instead of a popular and established Rab Butler who sat in the elected House of Commons. This dragged the Queen into the political arena, and she was criticised for her judgment. The appointment of an old Etonian lord in his 60s was seen as at odds with the prevailing mood. Journalist Malcolm Muggeridge questioned whether the country really needed a Queen. "She's dowdy, frumpish, and banal. If, as I consider, such a social setup to be obsolete and ill-advantageous in the contemporary world, then monarchy is to that extent undesirable." John Grigg, historian and a lord himself, said, "She is out of touch with the modern world, and her advisers are a tweedy entourage who know nothing of life outside the restricted circle of their establishment." This did not necessarily reflect all of public opinion. Grigg was attacked in the street following his comments. The honeymoon period of the 1950s was over. The opinion of the British people of the Queen by the 1960s seemed passive. On the 21st of October 1966, an avalanche of mud, water and debris from a coal mine buried a primary school in the South Wales village of Aberfan, killing 116 children and 28 adults. Though Philip arrived the next day, the Queen delayed her visit for more than a week, fearing her presence would distract rescue efforts. She had misjudged the public mood and was criticised. It was a decision she deeply regretted soon after. Inflation by 1969 meant the civil list no longer covered the cost of the royal households. Prince Philip's comments were met with ridicule and scorn. "I don't know. We may have to move into smaller premises. We had a small yacht which we had to sell, and I shall have to give up polo fairly soon." Dockers wrote a sarcastic letter to Buckingham Palace offering to buy the prince a polo pony. Sympathy was extremely limited. In the 1970s, the economy grew worse, with inflation as high as 16%. 3-day weeks introduced to limit energy costs, and 5 states of emergency caused by widespread industrial action. There were fears in the run-up to the Queen's Silver Jubilee in 1977 of widespread indifference. Manchester Town Hall announced plans to boycott celebrations. The Sex Pistols released an anti-monarchist single, God Save the Queen. Despite its BBC and retail ban, it became a hit. It only reached number 2, but many believe the BBC prevented it from reaching the coveted spot. However, the majority of the country still came out to celebrate the Jubilee, with 1 million people watching the parade and millions more partying in their streets. Elizabeth also struggled at times to balance the roles of queen and mother and sister. Back during the preparations for the coronation, Margaret approached the new queen for permission to marry Peter Townsend, a divorcee, 16 years her senior. The Queen, aware of lingering strictures around royal suitors, the Church of England still did not permit remarriage after divorce, asked Margaret to wait until after the coronation. The establishment remained firmly opposed to the marriage. The alternative for Margaret was a civil marriage, which would require a renouncement of her right to succession and her income. Margaret gave up on Townsend. Elizabeth gave birth to Andrew in 1960, and Edward in 1964. Andrew was the first child to be born of a monarch, or born in the purple, since Victoria gave birth to Princess Beatrice in 1857. Philip had been firm that their children attend school in order to mix with ordinary people. Charles, Andrew, and Edward attended his alma mater, Gordonston, in Scotland, and Anne attended Benenden School in Kent. There has been a great deal of disagreement over Elizabeth's performance as a mother, often painted as cold and distant, often due to the demands of a job. In particular, Charles has written of his unhappy childhood. He was bullied at Gordonston, and often took comfort from his relationship with his grandmother, the Queen Mother, rather than his own mother. In 1969, Philip and Uncle Louis Mountbatten pushed for a fly-on-the-wall documentary of the royal family to be made. It would show the Queen at work and the family at leisure. It aimed to improve the image of the royal family, which had been damaged in the 1960s. It became hugely popular, with many repeats broadcasted, and 40 million people, or 70% of the population, watched it. Emphasis was placed on the ideal family and proved to be a dangerous pedestal. Many were against it. David Attenborough, then head of BBC Two, said to its producer, "You're killing the monarchy with this film you're making. The whole institution depends on mystique and the tribal chief, Innes Hut. If any member of the tribe ever sees inside the hut, then the whole system of the tribal chiefdom is damaged, and the tribe eventually disintegrates." The royal family, after persistent calls for more material, refused, and also refused to permit any more repeats of the documentary. The 60s and 70s were also characterised by the full transition from empire to Commonwealth. When she became Queen, she was styled Queen of the United Kingdom, Head of the Commonwealth, and Queen of her other realms and territories, whereas her father had been styled King and Emperor. It signified the end of the British Empire. She was an honorary queen of individual dominions, with each having their own right to decide the degree of affiliation and commitment to the Commonwealth. The first few decades of Elizabeth's reign saw the acceleration of decolonization in Africa and the Caribbean. Britain's decline as a world power had become clear following the embarrassment of the Suez Crisis in 1957. 24 countries declared independence from the United Kingdom in the 1960s alone, including Kenya, Nigeria, Cyprus, Malta, and Jamaica, though more than half of those who declared independence remain part of the Commonwealth today. Bizarrely, in 1956, there were discussions around France joining the Commonwealth, which would have made Elizabeth head of state. It had been proposed by the French Prime Minister, Guy Mollet. Eden rejected the proposal, and France instead established the European Economic Community, the precursor to the European Union. Despite Elizabeth formally dismissing him, in Rhodesia, Prime Minister Ian Smith declared loyalty and devotion to Elizabeth, in opposition to the growing cause for independence. He led a majority white government, internationally isolated against the trend in Africa for a decade. After years of conflict, in 1978, Smith relented and the country would be later renamed Zimbabwe and declared independence under the leadership of Robert Mugabe in 1980. 1969 saw the beginning of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. The conflict, which ended with the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, saw over 3,500 people dead. In 1979, the Troubles affected the Queen personally when Lord Mountbatten and his son were killed by an IRA bomb. He had remained close to the royal family. In 2011, the Queen made her first state visit to Southern Ireland for a reigning monarch for 100 years, and the first since independence. A visit that would have been unthinkable in previous decades. She received plaudits by delivering a welcome in Irish. While the speech lacked an apology, she expressed her sincere thoughts and deep sympathy for the victims of the troubled Anglo-Irish past. She later met Martin McGuinness, Chief of Staff of the IRA, during the assassination of Lord Mountbatten. The Queen travelled extensively outside of the Empire and Commonwealth, with a number of historic visits. In 1965, she visited West Germany, marking the 20-year anniversary of the end of the Second World War to symbolise reconciliation, making her the first reigning British monarch to visit Germany since her grandfather, George V, on the eve of the war in 1913. The Queen became the first British monarch to visit China in 1986, visiting the Forbidden City, the Great Wall, and the Terracotta Warriors. The visit is perhaps now most remembered for a number of gaffes and racist remarks made by Prince Philip. Philip did provoke numerous public relations headaches over the years, with his off-the-cuff comments, none more so than in China. He called Beijing ghastly, and told a group of British students that they would get slitty eyes if they stayed in China too long. During a banquet, the Queen joked that the first British emissary to China had been lost at sea during the reign of her namesake Elizabeth I. Fortunately, postal services have improved since 1602. The visit would also signify acceptance of the transfer of sovereignty over Hong Kong from the UK to China, scheduled to take place in the following decade. In 1972, Elizabeth became the first British monarch to visit a communist country when she toured Yugoslavia. She was received by President Tito and became the first monarch to travel to Russia in 1994, following the end of Soviet communism. During some tours, the Queen's safety was called into question. During her trip to Ghana, President Kwame Nkrumah had become a target for assassins. He was later exiled after a coup d'etat. Elizabeth herself was also reportedly a target for an assassination attempt by extremists in the Quebec separatist movement. When visiting India in 1997, the Queen was heckled when visiting the site of the Amritsar massacre that took place in 1919, when British troops had fired on Indian protesters. Up to 1,500 protesters had been killed. There has still never been a formal apology issued. During the 1980s, concerns grew over the Queen's safety at home. During the 1981 Trooping of the Colour, a gunman at close range fired 6 shots as she rode on her horse. The Queen kept her composure, soothed her horse, and rode on. The shots were later discovered to be blanks. In Dunedin, New Zealand, in the same year, an assailant fired a very real shot from a building overlooking a royal parade. He missed and was jailed. In 1982, British criminal Michael Fagan was able to enter Buckingham Palace. He scaled a barbed wire-topped 14-foot wall and then shinnied up a drainpipe undetected. He reportedly walked around the palace, triggering the alarm twice. Each time, it was switched off, assuming the warnings were errors. He then wandered into the Queen's bedroom and sat on her bed. No one had been present guarding her door. Philip was away. Details of his encounter with the Queen differ significantly from source to source. According to some, the pair had a long conversation, while the Queen kept him occupied, waiting for security. According to Fagan, she simply walked past him and out of the room. Fagan was eventually apprehended. It was later reported that this was not the first time Fagan had entered the palace. With the growth of satire in the 1980s, the royal family were not exempt from ridicule, including the Queen herself. The royals became targets of sensational stories in the press. Sun editor Kelvin McKenzie told his staff, "Give me a Sunday for Monday splash on the royals. Don't worry if it's not true, so long as there's not too much of a fuss about it afterwards." Royal protocol of not commenting on stories meant they were fair game. Claims in the press were rampant in the 1980s that the Queen disagreed with various policies enacted by Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Reported by The Times in 1986, the Queen was worried about fostering social divisions, rising in unemployment, and the miners' strikes. Most notably, the Queen was reportedly disheartened by Thatcher's refusal to apply sanctions against South Africa during apartheid. Lots of stories around the time, it is claimed, were nothing more than journalist mischief-making. The royals also did not help themselves. In 1987, 23-year-old Prince Edward conceived and organised a show called It's a Royal Knockout, a one-off charity event inspired by It's a Knockout. It would see members of the royal family, including Edward, Anne, and Andrew, competing against one another, leading teams of celebrities competing in absurd slapstick games. It was viewed as undignified and was met with ridicule from the press. Edward stormed out of a press conference when journalists were not showing him, nor the event, the respect he felt it deserved. Over the decades and since the documentary, the Queen has kept her home life private. However, accounts offer a glimpse into her life. Margaret Rhodes, the Queen's cousin, once said that the Queen has a strict regimen for her alcohol intake. She reportedly took a gin and Dubonnet before lunch, with a slice of lemon and a lot of ice, wine with lunch, and a dry martini, and a glass of champagne in the evening. She ate rather frugally, eating small meals, including leftovers from the night before. She remained comfortable behind the wheel and would often drive around her estates in her Range Rover. She had a lifelong love of horse racing and owned many racehorses during her life. The coronation date had to be changed because it clashed with the Derby. She also owned 30 corgis during her life. They slept in their own room at Buckingham Palace in wicker baskets. She was also known to be a devout Christian and attended church every Sunday. She was also known for her dry wit. When she met a group of Americans on a walking holiday at a picnic site on the Balmoral Estate, they failed to recognise the Queen and asked where she lived. The Queen responded, "I have a house in London and a holiday home on the other side of the hills." When they asked if she had ever met the Queen, Elizabeth turned to her protection officer and said, "Well, I haven't, but Dickie meets her regularly." Tourists, impressed with the guard, then asked the Queen to take their photo with Dickie. The Queen obliged. Then they swapped places and Dickie took a picture of the pair with the Queen too. Later the Queen joked to Dickie, "I'd love to be a fly on the wall when he shows those photos to friends in America." She strove to be adaptable throughout her reign. In 1976 she sent her first email, in 2019 her first post on Instagram, and she also owned a Nintendo Wii. In 1981, Charles had married Diana Spencer in what was billed the wedding of the century. It was watched by an estimated 750 million people around the world. The pair had two children, William and Harry, born in 1982 and 1984 respectively. At the end of 1992, the Queen spoke of their torrid year. 1992 is not a year on which I shall look back with undiluted pleasure. In the words of one of my more sympathetic correspondents, it has turned out to be an annus horribilis. It saw her daughter Anne's divorce from Captain Mark Phillips. Andrew separated from Sarah Ferguson after photographs pertaining to her affair with a Texas oil magnate were published. Princess Diana released a tell-all book about problems in her marriage and Charles's affair with Camilla Parker Bowles. Finally, in November, Windsor Castle caught fire when a spotlight ignited a curtain. The property suffered extensive damage to 100 rooms and cost £36 million to repair. The government offered to foot the bill, which outraged the public. This led to the Queen voluntarily paying taxes on her personal income, the first time a monarch had done so. Royal residences were open to the public to help pay for the repairs. The Queen battled through 1992. However, the rest of the 90s would prove even more difficult and threaten the entire future of the royal family. In 1994, Charles went on television and admitted to having an affair with Camilla, and that his marriage had irretrievably broken down. In 1995, Diana gave an interview to BBC Panorama and Martin Bashir. 23 million people watched Diana blaming Charles for the breakdown of their marriage. She famously said, "There were three of us in this marriage." She then suggested that Charles wasn't up to the job of being king. Philip's correspondence with Diana were leaked. They painted Philip as direct and nasty. The full letters suggest, however, a real effort made by Philip to keep the marriage alive, with some paternal instinct for her daughter-in-law, perhaps also remembering his own experiences as a royal outcast. The popularity of the monarchy at this stage was at its lowest perhaps since Victoria's period of long mourning. It would further drop. At this point, the Queen instructed both Charles and Diana to get a divorce. Diana continued to be a target for the press. Rarely was she not featured on the front pages. In August 1997, she was killed in a car accident in Paris while being chased by paparazzi. Prime Minister Tony Blair reacted, "This is going to unleash grief like no one else has ever seen anywhere in the world." As predicted, the outpouring of grief was unprecedented and took the country by surprise. Mourners queued for 12 hours to sign books of condolence. Media coverage was completely dominated by the death of Diana. The Queen did not judge the public mood. Her reaction was seen as hugely out of step with a grieving nation. She remained quiet in the aftermath, while the country mourned. She had decided that silence and isolation would be better for her two grandsons, William and Harry, to keep them away from the public eye and to grieve privately at Balmoral. The sense was that the Queen should have been in London and should have been seen grieving in public. She faced unprecedented levels of criticism, with tabloids and broadcasts turning their attention to the monarch, perhaps to shield criticism directly at them for how they had regularly harassed the princess and the circumstances that led to her death in Paris. Headlines lacked reverence. The front page of the Express read, Show us you care. The Daily Mail and others campaigned for the flag at Buckingham Palace to be flown at half-mast, despite Diana not being a member of the royal family upon her death. On the 5th of September, the family returned to Buckingham Palace, 6 days after Diana's death, and a day before her funeral. There was a tense atmosphere when the Queen and the rest of the royals went to the gates of the palace to look at the thousands of flowers left in honour of the princess. There was a strong police presence due to the tension and hail of criticism directed at the Queen and others. On the same day, the Queen spoke to the nation. She acknowledged Diana's death and justified her own actions. This did help turn the public mood. 3 million people lined the streets for the funeral. 32 million people watched in Britain, second only to the World Cup final in 1966, and more than the Queen's own funeral. More than 2 billion people watched worldwide. Philip persuaded a reluctant William and Harry to walk behind the coffin during the procession. It was perhaps the darkest, most uncomfortable moment of the Queen's reign. 5 years on, in 2002, the Queen celebrated 50 years on the throne. There was some nervousness around the Golden Jubilee and the response the Queen would receive from the British public. Many in the media were predicting a washout. In the months leading to the Jubilee, Princess Margaret and the Queen Mother had died at the ages of 71 and 101, respectively. The Queen had been shaken. The trio had remained exceptionally close following the death of George. Nevertheless, as part of the Jubilee celebration, the Queen and Prince Philip travelled 40,000 miles around the Commonwealth and opened the Commonwealth Games in Manchester that year. A prom at the palace, a full RAF flyover, a balcony wave, and the party at the palace brought the celebrations to a close. The reaction was overwhelming, with enthusiasm shown for the Queen greater than many journalists had anticipated. In 2005, the Queen gave Charles her blessing to marry Camilla Parker Bowles. He was desperate to marry Camilla, and had been biding his time since the death of his ex-wife Diana, in order to not provoke the public. Times had changed considerably with regard to acceptable royal marriages. Royals are now expected to be able to marry anyone they choose. Both Charles and Camilla were divorced. This would not have been permitted before the reign of Elizabeth. Though Elizabeth did not attend the civil ceremony, she happily attended the reception. Before her death, she expressed her wish that Camilla be given the title of Queen Consort. 2012 marked 60 years on the throne. It was only the second Diamond Jubilee in British history. Younger members of the family took on the responsibility of Commonwealth visits, while the Queen and Philip toured the UK. In the same year, as Britain struggled with the toils of austerity, the civil list was abolished, a public funding system of the monarchy dating back 250 years. The Queen also cut back on personal spending. In the same summer, London hosted the 2012 Olympic Games. During the ceremony, the Queen starred in a skit with none other than James Bond, Daniel Craig. The film showed the Queen jumping from a helicopter into the Olympic Stadium to officially open the Games. She had reached the zenith of her popularity, with approval ratings of more than 90%. In December, she became the first monarch to attend a cabinet meeting since George III in 1781 as part of the Jubilee celebrations. The following year, with the birth of Prince George, the Queen's great-grandson through William, saw three direct heirs from three generations alive at the same time as the monarch. Only in the reign of Victoria had this previously happened. On the 9th of September 2015, Elizabeth surpassed Queen Victoria as the longest-serving monarch in British history. She later became the longest-reigning monarch in the world, upon the death of Rama IX, King of Thailand, in 2016. Although her final visit outside of Europe was in 2011 and her final foreign trip to Malta was in 2015, Even as the Queen turned 90, she was still making more than 400 engagements per year and maintained her support of hundreds of charitable organisations. Her final years were in part unsettled due to various family difficulties, some more serious than others. From 2019, Prince Andrew was stripped of titles and patronages following his connection with convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, and accusations of sexual abuse directed at Andrew himself. Andrew gave up his duties and ceased to be an active royal. In 2018, Prince Harry married Meghan Markle. Perhaps no other events during Elizabeth's reign had symbolised a modern monarchy more than this royal marriage to a divorced, biracial American actress. However, 18 months later, in early 2020, the new Duke and Duchess of Sussex announced that they would be stepping back from their roles as senior royals. They moved to Canada, and then to the United States, and have grown further and further apart from the royal family. The final major event of Elizabeth's reign was the COVID pandemic. In March 2020, COVID-19 forced Britain into a lockdown. She herself contracted COVID in April 2022, but made a full recovery. She spent lockdown at Windsor Castle, shades of her confinement during the Blitz 80 years before. On the 5th of April 2020, 24 million Brits watched the Queen deliver her final famous speech to an unsettled and panicked nation.
We will succeed, and that success will belong to every one of us. We should take comfort that while we may have more still to endure, better days will return. We will be with our friends again. We will be with our families again. We will meet again. But for now, I send my thanks and warmest good wishes to you all.
The following year, on the 9th of April, 2021, Prince Philip died at the age of 99. Philip had retired from royal duties 4 years prior, at the age of 96, spending his retirement at Sandringham, though he had spent lockdown at Windsor. They had been married for 74 years, a royal record. She said Philip's death left a huge void in her life. One of the most poignant images of the Queen in her final years of her reign was taken in the pews of St. George's Chapel, sat alone, wearing a mask due to COVID restrictions, mourning the loss of her husband during his funeral. In 2022, Elizabeth became the only monarch to celebrate 70 years on the throne. She had cut back considerably on her public duties, missing the state opening of Parliament for only the third time in 70 years, previously missing the ceremony due to pregnancy. Her appearances for her Platinum Jubilee were restricted to the balcony of Buckingham Palace due to her frailty, although she did record a video with Paddington Bear. On the 6th of September, she performed her final duty, appointing Liz Truss as Prime Minister. On the afternoon of the 8th of September 2022, the Queen died at the age of 96 at Balmoral Castle. Her funeral was watched by 26 million people in the UK and billions of people around the world. She was laid to rest in the King George VI Memorial Chapel at Windsor Castle, next to her parents and her husband. Elizabeth ruled for 70 years, the second longest verifiably recorded reign of any monarch in world history, behind only Louis XIV. For 4 out of 5 Brits, she was the only monarch they had ever known. It is a reign that saw the discovery of DNA, man walking on the moon, vaccinations created for polio and COVID, the invention of the mobile phone, the first test tube baby, the creation of the internet, and the World Wide Web. She will be remembered as perhaps Britain's greatest ever monarch. Arguably, the monarchy had become more influential the more its hard power declined. she maintained the elaborate ceremony and pageantry of the British monarchy. She knew that this was an important aspect of Britain's projected image. Soft power was at the core of the Queen's influence around the world, and through gentle persuasion rather than compulsion or force, particularly over 15 British prime ministers. The Commonwealth was a tool for the Queen to encourage international cooperation and friendship. She was in a unique position to deal with those world leaders who were disinclined to deal with elected officials. Even tyrants would jump at the chance to meet Elizabeth II. She made more than 21,000 engagements during her reign, including more than 260 official overseas visits. In a reign that was characterized by a redefinition of monarchy and empire, she offered calmness, reassurance, comfort, leadership, and perspective over perhaps the most significant period of social, economic, and technological change of any reign in British history. Despite the challenges of modern perspectives around the principles and practicalities of monarchy, her adaptability and strong sense of civic duty ensured its survival. Thank you for listening and thank you for joining me over the last 4 years. I started this project during the COVID lockdown. I wanted to create something to help pass the time. It feels like a long time ago. I've been overwhelmed by the comments and feedback I've received over the years and I'm very grateful. And you're the reason why I've managed to complete the series. I'm pleased to say that I am going to continue the podcast. I will go all the way back to Saxon England and produce episodes on the kings prior to the Norman Conquest, which I know some of you have already suggested, and some of you suggested that's where I should have started in the first place. I've got my Saxon books ready, and I can't wait to get started, so thanks again. Keep following my social media pages for updates on the coming series, and I will see you next time.